welcome to this week's episode of Military History Inside Out. Today I speak with author Peter Eicher, retired from the Foreign Service. He's written a book, Raising the Flag, about U.S. diplomacy history, diplomatic history, from the start of the country, from the beginning to right before the beginning of the Civil War. So he covers a very interesting era when the U.S. was just discovering itself, you know, finding its way in the international arena. So we talk about, and of course, since this is a military history podcast, we talk a lot about how the U.S. Navy was involved with early U.S. diplomatic history, a bunch of interesting anecdotes. Some of the diplomats were veterans, and also there were plenty of times when the U.S. Navy supported, in a sense, there were some funny stories about how the U.S. Navy supported or had to deal with some recalcitrant diplomatic persons. So you'll hear about that when you listen to the podcast. So anyway, I hope you enjoy. Thank you. I'm speaking with Peter Eicher, author of Raising the Flag, America's First Envoys in Faraway Lands. Thank you for speaking with me.
Well, I'm delighted to do it. Thanks for calling.
So first, tell me how you got into studying history and writing.
Well, I've always liked history. I studied it in college. I was a history major and was especially interested in diplomatic history. For me, it always conjured up images of faraway places and adventure and great events that shaped the world. So that partly led me into a career in the Foreign Service, where I continued to try to read and look into history in the different places I was. I remember even in my very first foreign assignment in Fiji, I visited a remote island to find the grave of John Williams, the first U.S. consul to Fiji. So Raising the Flag goes back very many years. That must have been in 1974, 75.
Mm-hmm.
I actually started writing history seriously for the first time in about 1990. I had a fellowship from the Una Chapman Cox Foundation to take a year off of my regular Foreign Service work to do some work on some writing on diplomatic history. So that's when I started seriously doing it, and when I wrote my first book, which was called Emperor Dead and Other Historic American Diplomatic Dispatches.
Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit about this book then. You mentioned before this is a diplomatic history, but it intersects a lot with U.S. military history.
Well, it does indeed. Raising the Flag tells the stories of some of America's first envoys, the people who raised the flag officially for the first time in a dozen different countries and places around the world. And it's really from the first maybe 70 years of American history. Pre-Civil War was the real era of flag raising, and a lot of these envoys were taken to their posts on U.S. naval ships, or were trying to negotiate commercial treaties, or some of them were even naval officers. Maybe the most military history chapter in it is a chapter about the first Barbary Wars and our first consuls in Tunis and Tripoli and Algiers, who were very much involved in the first American war in the Middle East. One of them, in fact, William Eaton, who was our first consul in Tunis, was the man who led the Marines, all eight of them, to the shores of Tripoli, which is still memorialized every time they sing the Marine hymn.
Right.
The others were also much involved. One of my chapters tells the story of American naval Commodore David Porter, who became a diplomat late in life and was our first resident envoy in Turkey, the Ottoman Empire as it was at the time. And although a tremendous amount has been written about David Porter, and particularly his exploits during the War of 1812, where he was a naval hero, I'd found that virtually nothing had ever been written on his 12 or 14 years of representing the United States in a foreign country. So those are two of the overlaps. There's also the story of David Roberts, who was our first envoy to Cochin China, as it was at the time, Vietnam and Siam, Thailand, and Muscat, now Oman, who did all of his extensive travels on U.S. On naval ships, initially disguised as the captain's assistant, because they didn't want the British in particular to know that we were out to try to negotiate treaties with these different countries. And there's a consistent pattern of consuls in a lot of countries early in the years of American diplomacy who were insisting on trying to get naval visits to their port because it would boost their prestige and power and influence over local events if they could get the Navy to do that. The Navy usually wasn't much interested, but now and then a ship would stop by, and sometimes it would help out with what the consul wanted, and sometime it would find them wanting, shall we say, not convincing in what they wanted to be done. So there was a certain amount of gunboat diplomacy, and a lot of America's early representatives were involved in it in one way and another.
So you touched on a question I wanted to ask, which was how coordinated or were the efforts between American diplomats and, the U.S. Navy?
Well, generally, at this time, American diplomats were very isolated and were given instructions before they left, and then they were either made their own way to their post, or as often as not, waited until a naval ship was headed that direction, which could take them there and deposit them there, and then they would be left on their own, largely, with their own judgment. And that's one of the reasons I ended the book in the pre-Civil War era, because diplomacy changed radically after that. Shortly after the Civil War, you had the introduction of transoceanic steamers on a regular basis, and the transatlantic cable, and the transcontinental railroad that got people to the Pacific very quickly. And so instead of taking sometime a year or more to send a letter home and get a response, it would be much quicker in the post-Civil War era in most places. So these guys were very much on their own. And coordinating from the post to try to get Washington to send the Navy out to do something really didn't happen very much. But having a naval ship come by and become involved could happen. I could give you a couple examples, and a couple of the chapters of my book deal with diplomats, consuls who were assigned to territories which are now part of the United States, one about New Orleans and one about California. We had a consul in California when it was still Mexican. And at one point, he was stationed in Monterrey, which was the capital of Mexico, of California at the time. And at one point, a naval squadron, the American Pacific Squadron, visited Monterrey, and Commodore Thomas Camp Apsby Jones occupied Monterrey. He thought that we might already be at war with Mexico and seized it. And contrary to the advice of the U.S. consul in this case, and a couple of days later realized that we were not yet at war with Mexico and handed it back again, which was an interesting incident. And that's one case of a naval officer acting against the wishes of a consul and doing too much. In another case, we had one of our early consuls in Tahiti, who was always begging for naval visits so that he could advance his own status and power, basically, had a visit by the U.S. exploring expedition back in the 1840s, and thought he could use this as an occasion to extort further privileges from the Tahitian government over supposed insults they had made to the American flag and to him personally. The head of the squadron found that the consul was not at all credible. The Tahitians had complained, for example, that he was a bootlegger and he was smuggling rum. So this became an issue, and the captain asked him, "Is this true?" And he said, and the consul said, "Absolutely not. You can search my house if you want to." And the captain said, "Yes, absolutely, let's search your house." And they did, and the consul was aghast, and they found that there was all kinds of rum stashed in his consular residence, which he had brought in, claiming that it would be for the use of the American naval visitors. In this case, Consul Blackler was told by the American Navy that, forget it, behave yourself.
Yeah.
Which he did not continue to do. So it was a mixed bag. You know, sometimes they got along well and could coordinate well. In this case, it was Wilkes who led the Pacific Exploring Expedition, and was the first time in many years that an American naval squadron had visited Tahiti. So there was great hopes on the part of the American consul, because British and French ships visited there all the time and often were able to convince the Tahitian government to do one thing or another by training their guns on the city and sometimes bombarding it. But in the American case, much more rarely, Washington seemed not to care so much about their consuls or their general relations with other countries. I think we were very inwardly focused at the time.
Yeah, I was going to ask, when diplomats or consuls were sent out, did the U.S. even think in terms of them starting an incident that would require military power? It sounds like you just said that it's just like, well, just go forth and do as you will.
Yeah, not quite, because they were sent with instructions, but they never really had a way to tell from Washington, certainly not quickly or easily, whether a person was following his instructions or not, and whether he was being effective in his job or not. And as I said, you know, you got out to some of these places like Tahiti or Siam, and it could take a year easily to get letters back and forth. The State Department, meanwhile, at the time was a tiny little operation with, you know, maybe up to a dozen clerks or something who spent most of their time laboriously hand copying instructions or mail to and from people. And one of the biggest complaints we had from our consuls as you go through the diplomatic records is that they just never hear from Washington. You know, it's like poor General Halftrack in Camp Swampy, you know, waiting to hear from the Pentagon and never hears. So when they were left largely to their own devices. Some did a marvelous job of negotiating treaties, advancing U.S. interests, and some did a terrible job that alienated local governments, or in the case of Tahiti, you could say the American consuls were largely responsible for it becoming a French territory to a large extent. In other cases, they would go way beyond their instructions. One colorful character was Joel Poinsett, our first envoy to Argentina and Chile. Mm-hmm. And in Chile, he ended up, while he was consul, serving simultaneously as a general in a Chilean Revolutionary Army. And leading troops against the Spanish royalists. He never reported home on having done that. But he figured, I guess, that America supported democracy and that was more important than his instructions not to meddle in internal affairs.
Interesting. So... So did they ever, it sounds like these consuls never went with any kind of military protection or any kind of protection at all, apart from the Navy showing up every now and then.
That's very much the case. You know, it's nothing like the diplomatic establishments it is today. It was usually one person going off to be dropped someplace and do the job. And in many cases, it was only a part-time job. You have the distinction between diplomats and consuls. They all reported to the State Department, but diplomats were officially accredited to represent the United States government with a foreign government, whereas consuls are supposed to protect U.S. citizen interests and promote trade. They're all also officially accredited, but they're not supposed to get involved in diplomatic deliberations. In fact, there was just a huge overlap between the two, because if you're the only representative in a country and your title is consul versus diplomat, you still do a lot of exactly the same things, and you're seen as a representative, and you act as a representative, and you're expected to act as a representative. So a tremendous overlap. But the consuls generally got no salary at all until the 1850s, and were expected to support themselves being traders or businessmen. They could keep their consular fees, but except for in a few of the largest posts, you know, the Liverpool, where you really had tremendous numbers of American ships, the consular fees weren't nearly enough to make a living off of. So there were potentially a lot of conflicts of interest there as well, but this apparently was not seen as a problem by the American government or taxpayers at the time. They can have a big consular establishment without having to have a big cost that goes along with it.
So I don't know if you touch on this in the book. Do you ever talk about when the Navy was sailing around to foreign countries, their effects on diplomatic relations, you know, areas where there might not have been an official diplomatic presence?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, indirectly, certainly. I mean, my book doesn't focus specifically on the Navy, but there's, as I said, there's a lot of overlap in the stories. One of the stories I mentioned, Edmund Roberts, our first envoy to Siam and Cochin China, when he sailed out on a naval vessel, was taking him around to do his diplomatic mission, and the first stop was supposed to have been to bombard the Malaysian town of Kuala Batu.
Mm-hmm.
For having a piracy problem. They had ransacked an American ship that had been in the harbor.
Mm-hmm.
And this order was given to two different American ships which were going to sail to the Pacific, because they never knew whether one would make it or turn back, or which one might get there first, or who might be lost at sea or whatever back in those days, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So in Roberts's case, he was lucky enough that the other ship got there first and bombarded Kuala Batu, and he didn't have to worry about that as part of his diplomatic mission.
Mm-hmm.
There was probably more U.S. gunboat diplomacy going on than we like to remember, and that's just one of quite a number of examples.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting that they, rather than go after the pirates, they just go ahead and bombard the city where, I guess, the pirates are based, or the town.
That's, yes. I think that's was kind of a common practice at the time, not just by the United States, but by the other major European powers. But yes, if they would not give proper reparations and guarantees for the future, they could get bombarded. And that Kuala Batu episode was one of the low points, I think, in American naval history. The captain, whose name slips my mind now, was eventually reprimanded because he was supposed to go in and ask for reparations and try to negotiate a settlement, and instead he snuck in disguised as a merchant ship and set the Marines ashore and bombarded the town and set fire to what was left. So then they were back again 20 years, I think, later to do about the same thing in the same place, so that shows how effective it turned out to be.
So that's an interesting interplay between American commerce, diplomacy, and the U.S. military. You know, did the United States keep tabs of where merchants were going in case there were problems, or was it basically just react when, if an American ship were bothered or harassed or something, they just respond as best they could?
It was kind of a combination. The general reason that we would send a diplomat on a mission or assign a consul to a place was most often to promote trade and promote commerce. And it's, striking all through the book the extent to which our first establishments in different places had to do with promoting trade.
Mm-hmm.
There was a definite interest in Washington in trying to create treaties of commerce and friendship, to the extent of, appointing diplomats to do it and sending them out in naval ships with lots of presents to try to make these treaties. And in some cases it was very successful. For example, on the Roberts mission, they negotiated a nice treaty with Siam, but failed, and in Muscat as well, but failed miserably with Cochin China for different kinds of reasons. But when there were incidents that would make their way back to Washington, the Congress would get energized. The president often would get energized. The particular one we've been talking about was during the Andrew Jackson administration, and he was a strong arm when it came to things like that, and even reported on the diplomatic missions and the chastisement of the pirates, as they like to call it, in his State of the Union addresses. So, you know, it was something which was not a small hidden thing. It reached high levels.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you know, we had a very limited Navy, especially at the beginning. I guess one of the things you see in the book as well is how it grows as the years go by.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Barbary case, for example, the reason that we first reestablished our Navy, which was disbanded after the Revolutionary War, was to deal with the Barbary states, which were seizing American ships and enslaving Americans and demanding ransoms.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you see what did you see as sort of the comparative ratio as the diplomatic corps grew over this period? Did the Navy seem to grow to keep up with issues that were popping up, or did you see any kind of trends in that way?
Yeah, the Navy certainly grew a lot faster than the diplomatic corps did. We even by the time of the Civil War, we had maybe 30 diplomatic establishments around the world, if that many, and each one probably had a maximum of two or three people, usually just one. If it had two, it was usually somebody bringing their son or their nephew along to act as diplomatic secretary for them. So it was a tiny diplomatic establishment. The consular corps was much bigger because, as I said, they weren't paid,
mm-hmm.
and it turned out to be a great place for patronage. And so under the Jackson administration, it really blew up, especially with the spoil system.
Mm-hmm.
And hundreds of people were handed consular assignments to ports and non-ports all over the world, where generally they had little influence and little income, and a lot of them turned out to be unhappy. They thought they were getting a plum, but when they got out to some little Caribbean or South American or African port, it was far from lucrative or a happy experience for many of them.
Hmm.
The Navy, meanwhile, grew much faster. I think after the Barbary Wars, there were the first Barbary War, there was no question of disbanding the Navy anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And it was still, small compared to Great Britain in particular,
mm-hmm.
Which ruled the seas, and to France and some of the others, but it grew consistently.
Mm-hmm.
And really, by the Civil War time, it was reasonably formidable with some transoceanic steamers as well, with Commodore Perry steaming into Japan, for example.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask you about the resources you used for your research.
Mm-hmm.
What did you use?
I used primarily the National Archives, which hold the basic diplomatic collections. They've got all of the incoming and outgoing diplomatic correspondence since the beginning of the United States, and it's just a fantastic collection. A lot of it has been put on microfilm, which makes it a little bit easier to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, what's been put on microfilm is the handwritten letters that were sent back and forth between diplomats and Washington, which could be a real challenge sometime. A lot of these guys, in fact, a lot more of them than these days, had beautiful cursive handwriting, which is a pleasure to look at and read, although it takes a lot of time. But some of them just had a miserable scrawl, which was a tremendous challenge to try to get through. So that was the main source, was American Diplomatic Archives, most of it unpublished. And also the Library of Congress. I'm lucky to be here in Washington, where we have both the archives and the Library of Congress, which is has a lot of personal papers of some of the characters in the book, and as well as virtually every other possible book and record anybody could want.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, these people who went out as envoys were well educated and knew that they were doing something important, and often making history when they were the first American representatives of place. And so they left a very nice trail of letters and diaries and journals and reports, as well as reports to the State Department, which give a lot of history. Again, most of it which hasn't even been published yet. So it was a lot of fun to dig through. I really did enjoy doing it. I love discovering the new stories, plucking gems out of dusty archives, and I know there's still an awful lot of it there.
What percentage of the people that you researched had some kind of military experience in their background?
Well, that's a good question. I didn't think of it in those terms, but I would think many certainly did, and a lot of them were the first crop of them tended to have served in the Revolutionary War.
Mm-hmm.
For example, our first representative in China, Samuel Shaw, had been an aide-de-camp to General Henry Knox in the Revolution. Knox rose to be the second leading general after George Washington.
Mm-hmm.
So he had served through the entire revolution. He joined up back at the time of Washington attacking Boston, you know, at the very, very beginning of the revolution, and served throughout. And then, again, in the Barbary Wars, chapter, William Eaton, the man who led the so-called attack to the shores of Tripoli, had been an Indian fighter, out in Ohio and Georgia and so forth, as well as having served in the Revolution. David Porter, of course, was a Commodore.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I would say a good number of them, maybe a third or a half, was not necessarily something that was regarded as something they had to have had in their background, but that did, if they did have it in their background, it could make them a little bit more prominent and maybe more likely to get one of these appointments, which were often, well, always political appointments at the time.
Mm-hmm. And I ask because when you mentioned the records that you searched, I wonder how many of them sort of had a military style to them, maybe, you know, the way they kept their records and such, if there was even a style of that, you know.
Yeah, I'm not, you know, I didn't look at lots of military records except as it related to some of the wars and incidents that I was dealing with. I wouldn't think there would be a specific style. There was a State Department style they were supposed to adhere to. And it's kind of funny. David Porter, the Commodore, was constantly being reprimanded by the State Department for not submitting his reports in the required style. For example, he wouldn't number his reports, so they never knew whether he, you know, they had missed one or not.
Yeah.
What they did at the time was require the diplomats to submit their reports on paper of a certain size with very wide margins so that they could be bound into logbooks in order. And Porter was particularly bad about that. You don't see a lot of reprimands from the State Department in these early days, but he managed to get a lot of them. He was, however, a good friend of President Jackson, and his job was safe, despite him having caused a number of different kerfuffles in his time in Turkey.
So, did you come across any noteworthy historic documents that you really enjoyed getting your hands on?
Well, yeah, quite a lot. I just like to read historic documents, and some of them were startling or interesting or funny. If we're talking about David Porter, he recruited another young to be his secretary in Turkey, against the wishes of the State Department, even because it was a long story. There was already what they called a dragoman translator attached to the legation in Turkey when Porter went, and they wanted him to continue, but Porter immediately got in a fight with him and insisted again that he had to hire a wonderful assistant, William Hodgson, who really was a wonderful assistant. But Porter was impossible to get along with, and before long he wanted to fire Hodgson as well. And the department, the State Department, wouldn't let him do it. And there is just an interminable correspondence between Porter and the State Department, pretty much one-sided. Porter just writing long letter after letter after letter, complaining about the impertinent Hodgson, and you've got to get rid of this guy so that I could hire my nephew instead for the job. Eventually, they finally reassigned Hodgson just to end the complaint. But I mean, this is the kind of even 200 years later, it was embarrassing to read these vituperative letters from Porter back to the State Department. It's the kind of unusual document you come across. Another one, which I quoted at substantial length in the book, is from California, a description of the California Gold Rush from our special diplomatic representative in California, Thomas Larkin, who had served as the first and only consul in Monterey for many years, and still held his assignment in 1848 when gold was discovered there, even though it had become American in the interim. Just a fantastic letter back about multiple letters back about they seem to have found gold, and all these fantastic stories are coming in that you know, I can't believe it all, so I'm going to go take a visit myself and see you. Next letter. Oh my God, you know, it's even more than the wild stories. And the next letter, all of the ships coming into Monterey and to San Francisco are losing their crews instantly, and everybody's heading to the gold fields. The whole enmity between the Americans and the Mexican Californians that had led to this. Been a war just less than a year before it disappeared as everybody headed to the gold fields. Really, yes, remarkable documents. Hmm. One other interesting aspect, I think, of this whole thing was the extent to which a lot of the stories reflect today's headlines. We're still dealing with the same stuff. The first consul in China dealing with trade deficits with China. Mm-hmm. You know, the Chinese, we wanted to buy a lot of Chinese stuff, and in this case, tea, and they didn't want to buy very much of our stuff. Americans at war in the Middle East, well, you know, it's still going on. Mm-hmm. First envoy to Mexico and our strained relations with Mexico and our interventions in Latin America. Mm-hmm. It's still an issue. Tensions with Turkey, you know, it's happening all over again. Mm-hmm. Political appointees as ambassadors who get themselves into trouble and undercut American interests. History doesn't quite repeat itself, but you can certainly see a lot of parallels to what was happening almost 200 years ago and what's going on now.
Yeah, yeah, it's pretty amazing.
It truly is, yeah.
So you mentioned much of what you enjoyed when you did your research. Is there anything that really stands out in particular, something that you enjoyed?
You know, I love digging in the dusty archives and pulling out stories, finding new ones. I mean, my book is not Benjamin Franklin and John Quincy Adams and the ones people know best. I think most people would pick up this book and may never, you know, unless they're really military or diplomatic history buffs, may never have heard of a lot of the people I'm dealing with. Mm-hmm. And to dig out some stories which really haven't been told. I haven't mentioned, for example, Daniel Clark, our first consul in New Orleans back when it was French and mm-hmm. Spanish. And you know, if you everybody thinks they know the story of the Louisiana Purchase and Louisiana becoming American, but I think they need to think again if they look at the chapter. Daniel Clark, who nobody has ever heard of, the lone consul in New Orleans, had a lot to do with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, there were still difficulties there right up to the last moment about whether the territory would actually go to the United States. But New Orleans was so isolated that they were not getting the news from Paris and Washington and Madrid. And there was lots of tensions on the spot, and the head of the American military forces at the time, General Wilkinson, was actually on the Spanish payroll, so he was unwilling to send his troops down there. So there's a lot of intrigue around that, and to ferret out that kind of story, I just found very satisfying, because it was one which, as far as I could tell, had not really been spelled out before.
Yeah, because I think, in general, I think people are just taught, you know, Napoleon needed the money and wanted to get rid of Louisiana, and Thomas Jefferson said, well, okay, we'll buy it, and end of story.
Yeah, and that's you know, that's the big story, but there's a lot more to it than that, of course. So, so some of the stories in my book are better known, although again, sort of in the way you describe, people know the big events. Okay, we had the Mexican War and got California, and we had the Louisiana Purchase and got New Orleans, and we had a Barbary War and put them down. But the personalities and the details really have a lot of fascinating personal stories and intrigues and swashbuckling and heroes and scoundrels, and you know, some of it is just stranger than fiction almost. You wouldn't believe some of this stuff when you read it. Mm-hmm. So it's in that sense, you know, I should emphasize that Raising the Flag is not a general history of U.S. diplomacy, and it's not intended to be at all. It's really a storybook. Mm-hmm. It tells the stories of these amazing men and circumstances, but at the same time, I think there's stories with lessons and morals, and to me, one of the morals is that I think people tend to, these days especially, to forget the value of diplomacy that it's had in preventing conflicts and ending wars and building alliances, promoting democracy and expanding trade, and generally making the U.S. safer and stronger and better respected. So I hope that the book will lead to a greater public appreciation of what our diplomats have accomplished and what they continue to do.
Mm-hmm. What did you find that was most surprising in your research?
Most surprising? You know, I guess perhaps it's the extent to which these guys were really on their own and individuals could drive policy in ways that I don't think could happen today with our instant communications and careful instructions and large bureaucracies. So that, you know, I knew that there was some of that, but I guess I hadn't realized the extent or impact of it in various places.
What would you say was the most difficult thing to research, either an issue that you still don't quite have a handle on or something that just took a lot more research than everything else?
The most difficult thing was one that I think I mentioned in passing, which was trying to read some of the handwriting in these things. You know, the typewriters didn't come into common use until maybe the 1890s, early 1900s, and it was a tremendous challenge. I mean, to the point where I almost would have given up on some of the stories because I couldn't struggle through the people's handwriting anymore, rather than other. But in terms of the issues, it's there. You know, there's just so many documents, and you know, if you had enough time, I could probably do three more volumes on wonderful stories that haven't been told. And that I think was a very kind of a happy surprise. You know, there's really a lot out there that has not been done, stories that haven't been told, and stories that haven't been told that really do reflect a lot of U.S. history that I think a lot of people would be interested in, people who are interested in reading history and nonfiction and foreign affairs and world affairs. It's quite amazing what the background of some of these things are.
Was there anything you discovered that emotionally moved you, either something that was sad or something that made you laugh or, you know?
Well, quite a lot, I guess, all in all. I talked about cringing at some of this stuff that David Porter was sending home. There's the the story of James Leander Cathcart, who spent 11 years as a slave in Algiers after he was captured by the Barbary pirates, and rose through his wits to become the chief Christian secretary of the day of Algiers. The story of Joe Poinsett, the first envoy to Argentina and Chile and later Mexico, and at one point, although he was deeply involved in Mexican politics, there were at one point riots in the streets when there was a very conservative group in power, and the liberals were rioting. Poinsett was a strong supporter of the, very active supporter, yet a lot of the conservatives sought refuge in his home during the riots, and he carefully strode out onto the balcony of his home, waving an American flag and telling the rioters to stand down, and had a bullet go through his coat. It didn't hurt him, but quite a touching story of an American sheltering foreigners with whom he disagreed, and using the flag for that purpose.
Interesting.
And then, perhaps one of the most touching of all is the story of Townsend Harris, who I haven't mentioned. Everybody's familiar with Commodore Perry steaming into Japan. But he steamed into Japan and achieved practically nothing. Even the official report of his own expedition says that the main goal was to achieve a commercial treaty, and they did not achieve a commercial treaty. But one thing he did achieve was to be able to assign a consul to Japan, and the Japanese kind of hoodwinked him and said, why don't you set up the consulate in Shimoda? That's a very nice place, but it's actually a very, very remote little village. I mean, not far as the crow flies from the capital, of Yedo, as it was at the time, but over high mountains and very isolated. Yeah. So they dropped Townsend Harris off there, and in about 18 months of hard work and perseverance, with virtually no contact whatever by any American ship or any American military, he managed to forge mutual respect with his Japanese hosts, and a treaty that achieved even more than Perry had been sent out to do.
Wow.
So really a struggle of adversity and loneliness and hard work and an individual making something happen. It's really something to admire, and even occasionally bring a tear to your eye.
Right, yeah. So, can you speak to any difficulties you had in getting the book published and how you overcame those?
I guess the one difficulty I faced was when I had finished my initial draft, I got a lot of advice that it was way too long. So I put another couple of years into trying to cut it down to something of a length that a publisher might actually want to publish. But I was working with an organization called the Association for Diplomatic Studies and Training, which is affiliated with the State Department, and which has put out a series of books, Diplomats and Diplomacy series of books. And actually my first book, which I mentioned earlier, Emperor Dead and Other Historic Diplomatic Dispatches, was the very first volume in the series 20 years ago. So they did get some peer reviews of my draft of Raising the Flag and thought it would be a good addition to the series.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually volume 63 of the series, so they've done a lot in the last 20 years.
Yeah.
And so they took charge of finding me a publisher, and I didn't have to go through that process myself, and came up with Potomac Books of the University of Nebraska, which I found easy to work with, and they had very, very few changes or suggestions for me to make in the text.
Okay. What's your next writing project?
Well, that's a question. I don't have anything really on the front burner, but I do have a couple projects in very early stages. I'd mentioned early in our conversation, maybe before you even started recording, that we had lived in France, and I did a lot of research on Americana in Paris. Might be putting together something that I've been collecting stories and anecdotes, and it might eventually turn itself into a book. There's a lot of fascinating history there as well. Things that people tend not to know, like Fulton's first steamboat wasn't on the Hudson; it was on the Seine.
Hmm.
And there's a hidden little plaque there that talks about it. Anyway, there's a thousand stories like that. It seems like every famous American artist and writer and scientist and politician has been to Paris and left his mark. I found many of them that I think could be of interest.
Yeah, that would be really fun to read.
Yeah. So we'll see whether that turns itself into something or not. I'm basically retired now, and so I have a little bit more time to see if I can put it together or not.
Okay. So I guess people can find the book on Amazon and University of Nebraska
yeah.
Press. Do you have your own website for any of your stuff or any social media?
I do not have my own website, but yes, it's available on Barnes & Noble and Amazon and many online sellers, including the University of Nebraska. So, I hope it's something people would enjoy. It's meant to be popular history rather than academic history.
Mm-hmm.
So as I say, it's a storybook. It's stranger than fiction, but it's all true.
Mm-hmm.
And so I hope it's the kind of thing people would enjoy.
Well, you seem to have delved into many things that people wouldn't have hasn't seen the light of day really before. So that's the fascinating part of it, I think.
Yeah, I think people would find enough familiar things in there that they know the outlines of most of it, and even a few of the stories, perhaps, but I think that even experts of diplomatic history would read this and find a lot of stuff they don't know.
So that's all I have. Any final thoughts?
No, I think that's it. I appreciate the interview.
All right. Yep. Thank you. Thank you for listening. One of the best ways to provide feedback on this podcast is to rate it on iTunes. Please let me know if you liked it, or give me a poor rating if you didn't like this podcast, and I can use that feedback to hopefully get better. Otherwise, please follow me on Instagram at Chris Alvarez War Scholar, on YouTube under War Scholar 1945, on Twitter at War Scholar, on Facebook under War Scholar, and you can find more information on my website, warscholar.org. Please remember, my name Chris does not have an H, so it's CrisAlvarez. Thank you, and I hope you continue to enjoy this podcast.